It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Thanks for downloading this week's episode of the Attacking Scrum podcast. This is the last in our series of Dream 15, where we get a guest to come on and join us in order to pick their fantasy team of all time. And it's a great one to finish on. It's the former Fiji Sevens coach, Ben Ryan, obviously turned inventor by creating the Rugby X version of the game as well. And really one of the smartest brains in world rugby. So a really good, interesting guy to chat to. And actually, for a bloke who has spent so much time being an innovative coach, it was really nice to chat about some of the old school things about rugby. And Ben, of course, was a player back in the day in kind of straddling the early era of professionalism. And he's got some great stories and picked his side accordingly, basically based on some of the antics that they got up to back in the day. So really enjoyed chatting to Ben. Really bright guy, but also a really funny and engaging guy too. So thanks to all the guests who joined us for Dream 15 nearly 4 months really. So we really enjoyed doing them, and thanks to everyone for listening. So as of next week, we'll be going back to a more current affairs style version of the show. So I hope you can join us for that. As always, we'll have some more great guests joining us too. And of course, a big thanks to our sponsors at So Coffee Trades. Right, hope you enjoy the show.
Robert Jones, nicely out to Emir Lewis. Emir Lewis is chipped it, up goes Yayan Evans. Yayan Evans is away. Can the Welsh captain make it? He's going to do it. And it's a try for Wales. And the Welsh captain.
Welcome to another episode of Dream 15 from the Attacking Scrum. Every week throughout lockdown, we've had a guest join us to choose a fantasy team made up of their favourite players. Joining me on this episode is one of rugby's great innovators, a hugely successful coach in Sevens, first in charge of England, then of course leading Fiji to their first ever Olympic medal when they won gold at Rio Olympics. Since then, he's turned inventor, pioneering a shorter form of the game in Rugby X, and it's a big welcome to Ben Ryan. How are you, Ben?
I'm really well, Jed. Thanks for inviting me on. This is a cool pod, and I get to talk about different things, so I'm excited.
we're delighted to have you on board, and really looking forward to seeing who's going to make up your team. just before we get underway, I mean, obviously we're living through very strange times right now. I guess rugby really finds itself in at something of a crossroads. As someone who's very much still involved with the game and is never short of an opinion or two, do you think there's a real opportunity to kind of reshape the game as a result of the whole COVID scenario, really?
Yeah, I do. I think on a number of levels, really. I think, you know, certainly if the stuff that I guess I'm spending more time on is the Sevens side, and that can have a whole restructuring now, because it doesn't really work in its current format. It's not very, hasn't got enough reach as a TV product. It's too long, but it's got such potential. So I think, yeah, that could definitely be one of them. And I think in the 15s game, you know, the fact that the Prem in England, Premiership teams were starting to furlough staff after only a couple of weeks of lockdown shows you just how hand to mouth a lot of these teams are, and that reducing salary caps, having perhaps talking about now, I don't like the word ring fencing, but I do like the expansion type setup where, you know, those sort of things, so that you can allow those teams a bit more safety and security around no relegation, still allow the opportunity for teams to come into that. And change the season and look at the timings of all of that. I think now's the chance to do that. And also, I think internally, it gives all the clubs a chance to spring clean a little bit. I think they've got quite a top heavy with numbers of management and coaches, and I think they can trim all of that and realise that perhaps less might be more for them going forward.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's going to be fascinating to see how this, see how it all plays out, really. And I think that all of those problems that you've mentioned there have been there in rugby almost since the start of professionalism. And I suppose it's taken a situation like this to bring everyone to the table. And hopefully that we are going to end up with a more sustainable version of the game, both sevens and 15.
Yeah, I hope so. And it's interesting. A lot of the stuff that I'm going to talk about, my picking my teams, now it's nice to be able to talk about that, actually the playing side of rugby, because I think everyone thinks of me as a sevens coach, but I did play not particularly well, and also coach 15s, and that's also, so I get a chance to talk about that now. And a lot of this team will be from that start of professionalism. Yeah. That's when I was playing the game.
Great. Well, we're looking forward to doing that. As you say, they're swapping sevens for Dream 15 today. So what criteria have you opted for when picking your side?
Well, I thought rather than just choose kind of the best player that I can think about that I've played with, against or coached, which, I don't think there's too much fun in that. I thought I'd just pick players that I've played with, against or I've coached, that I've got a bit of a story at least towards it, and why I put them in, and it kind of threads as well. I've used the thread of my playing career as well for some of these, and the different clubs and positions that I played over my time.
Fantastic. Well, let's start with loose head prop then. As you say, they're having spent a lot of your career in the shorter forms of the game. I'm really intrigued to see how you go about selecting the front row. Are we looking at a bunch of grizzled scrummages here, or talk us through your loose head.
Yeah, combination really. I've gone for somebody I played with at Loughborough University and Cambridge University at Loosehead, a guy called Gavin Reynolds, who played at Saracens as well. And I picked him really because we played in kind of the amateur professional days. So he was at Cambridge Uni with me. And I just remember one time when we were playing a touring Japanese side, and after the games, you go to one of the colleges. I think we were at Queen's in Cambridge, and after the game, the opposite player presented you with a miniature version of your shirt in their colours, and then he sat down next to you, and he basically said, "Right, we're going to go head to head and drink all night." Now, again, I was okay because I wasn't a big drinker, but my opposite man was just over 5 foot, and so it wasn't long before he had disappeared. And that was continuing as I looked left and right down the tables. Everybody was doing the same. Gav Reynolds, the Loosehead, was kind of the guy that took the mantle as being our best drinker. And he got absolutely wasted by this Japanese prop opposite him. So we found the program. We got the picture of this guy. We blew up his head picture to big poster size. And he had to have that above his bed for the rest of the year, just to remind him that... there's always someone better than you around the corner. So that's why I thought I'd just start it off, because it's not all about professional rugby and a little bit of fun there, I guess.
Lovely throwback to the amateur era. I'm sure Gav Reynolds will be delighted that he's been given another one shirt for that reason. So that is as good a reason as any. So it'll be Gavin Reynolds in at Loosehead. Let's move on to Hooker.
Yeah, Hooker was a guy that I played with and against. I played against him when he toured with Samoa, or it was actually Western Samoa back then, Trevor Leota. And then I weirdly played with him. So he was fantastic we played, luckily at Cambridge, we played them 2 years in a row, Western Samoa, beat them in my first year, and then lost by a point in the second year. And Trevor was playing at Hooker, and then a little bit later on, I ended up in the bizarre circumstances playing for Pacific Islanders at scrum half, and Trevor was playing at open side at the time, and I had to organise the warm up and try to organise some line outs and scrums, but they just called in Fijian if it was going to the front, Samoan if it was going to the back, and Tongan if it was going to the middle, which didn't help me at all. But it was a lot of fun. I just thought he was like a hooker that was just all over the field, hit people really hard, didn't take the game too seriously, and was a good guy to have on your side. And luckily I managed to have that after having to go opposite him earlier on in my career.
I remember years and years and years ago reading an article in either the Times or the Guardian, and it said everyone has a favourite Leota story except those who are still too traumatised to talk about it, which, you know, he's an absolute fearsome competitor and, you know, like you say, everywhere across the pitch, but so powerful, ball carrying, huge hits, you know, must be a dream to play with and a nightmare to play against.
Yeah, and I guess you kind of like, also like back in the day then, you got to know your hookers quite well because you had to make sure that when the scrums came, that you were absolutely getting your put in spot on and it was going right to where he wanted for his foot placement to actually strike the ball, which hasn't happened for many, many years. And if you ever got that wrong and you didn't see his tap or you didn't get things right, you know, he would look bad because they've got one against the head and you'd get it from him straight away. So you really had to build up that that relationship with your hookers. But he just was a little bit different to everybody else.
Amazing. Well, so far in your two selections, we've spoken about drinking ability and actually hooking the ball. So we really are a little throwback to the amateur era, aren't we? It's good stuff. Yeah. Let's see if that continues with your tight head.
Yeah, maybe. It's After I was at Cambridge and I was just waiting to try to get onto my second year of a postgraduate course, and I played for Bedford when Paul Turner was coaching, and there was quite a lot of money coming in and it was backed really well. And Jeff Probyn was playing at tight head. So Jeff is my tight head. And I remember playing against Rugby Lions, and Paul hadn't picked me up at scrum half. He'd chucked me on the wing, on the left wing, because he liked the fact that I could kick well off my left foot. So he put me on the left wing and has an option there. And I hurt my knee in a double tackle. And I was also worried then that I wouldn't get my chance to go to Cambridge to do my second year. And my funding was reliant on me being able to fit and play rugby as well. And Jeff just saw me on the table and looked at my knee and goes, "Oh, you fucked your ACL. That's you done." And as a 20-year-old or whatever I was, I was pretty depressed after that. And he didn't say it with any tone of sympathy. He just looked at it and thought, "Well, that's, you know, he's gone," and walked out the door. I remembered that because it's a bit of a lesson on perhaps how not to deliver bad news to somebody. But that was his way, and I guess that's the way he played the game as well. He wasn't the biggest, but he was just an amazing scrummager.
Yeah, certainly uncompromising player. Yeah, maybe keep him away from delivering any of the medics news from this side. But another old school prop in Jeff Probyn. Doesn't get much more old school than that. Let's move on to the second row, of course. What are we opting for here?
Yeah, well, you say not. This might be just as much old school. So when I was at Loughborough, I also played for Nottingham for the Green and Whites in Beeston back in the day, and I had gone there because Dusty Hare was coaching, and he had watched me play for, I think it was London under 19s or something like that, and Stuart Potter had just gone. Nottingham got relegated from what was top division. And the best players had gone to Leicester, like Stuart Potter, who's a centre, and Neil Back, and a few others. And so he had got me in to come in as a inside centre. And luckily, back in the day, then it wasn't about size; there was a bit more about it. And so I joined Nottingham, and the captain of the team was Chris Gray, who was also playing for Scotland at the time and was second row in the team that I think won the Grand Slam in 1990. And I played my first friendly. And then I got a 180-day ban for a registration ban back then. So I had played, I'd been training pre-season with my local club, Richmond, and signed some sort of membership form that I wasn't sure what it was. But it turned out that it was a registration form to play for them. And you had to wait 180 days before you could play in the league, which was pretty much the whole season. And then when I got back to playing, I got sent off for allegedly kicking someone in the head. And it wasn't actually me. I wasn't that type of player. But I got another 45-day ban for that. So in my first year, I think 225 days of bans. And then when I finally did get to play, I got on the bench against West Hartlepool. And back then, you only got on if there was an injury. And we went all the way up to Hartlepool. We lost. I didn't get on. We then had the bus ride back where it was the forwards versus the backs having a fight on the bus. And I somehow managed to evade everybody by hiding. And they realised I was the only back left. And Dorian West was playing for Nottingham and Chris Gray. They took me into the toilets on the bus, gave me a bit of a kick in. And I came off the bus with two big black eyes, came home to London. My dad picked me up and said, oh, it must have been a cracking game. You were right with these. And I just said, yeah, I think I played okay. And I couldn't tell him that I'd been beaten up in the toilet by two of my teammates. And so Chris gets number four slot for that. And he was a very nice man. He's a dentist, actually. He's my number four.
Yeah, well, hopefully he's carrying out the dental work with a bit more care than the way he kind of readdressed your face on that day. But another fantastic reason to select him in the side. Just before we go on to talk about the other second row, well, you've mentioned some brilliant clubs in there. You know, the Bedfords and the Nottinghams and the West Hartlepools and all of these kind of things. Mm. It's I suppose that's something that, to go back to our earlier point right at the start of the pod, those clubs finding their role in the modern games, it's a really difficult thing, isn't it? Because I think anyone who remembers rugby in the amateur era has such fondness of either, you know, playing or watching those clubs. But it is such a commercial entity now, rugby, that it's hard for them to find their way. You know, what is the long term future for clubs like that?
Yeah, I agree. And I think we don't want to go back to where it was, where, you know, the fixture list was a combination of a lot of friendlies and then I think it was like a dozen or so league games and not much more, and there was a little bit of relegation and promotion, but it didn't have that professionalism as a calendar of fixtures. But I think I mean don't get me wrong, I love the Premiership as it is, but I think it needs expansion. And I think those clubs have all got to find their feet, because I've been at clubs, whether it's Nottingham or Hartlepool or Bedford or Richmond or Newbury, that have had a massive roller coaster of going down, you know, a number of divisions, but also have had to sell grounds on multiple occasions and people lose jobs because they've got it wrong and they haven't realised, you know, that what they're trying to achieve just wasn't achievable. And you know, Newbury's a good example that, you know, it went down about seven leagues. I coached them as director of rugby. We took them to, I think, about fourth in the Championship, and, you know, we lost by a point to Northampton Saints when they came down from the Premiership. But they tried to like chase that dream and ended up, you know, having to drop down all those leagues. But now they're an amazing community club. They've found their feet in a decent level. And they've got a thriving mini and junior section, and it's a real local hub. And I think, you know, that's a good example of understanding where you are. And Richmond have done the same. You know, they know where they want to get to, and they know that there's other parts of the club that are just as important. That the amateur game is the heartbeat of what we love about the game, and we can't just forget about that and risk it at the because of what we want to do at the top.
Yeah, it's a fantastic point. Let's bring it back to your side then. Who's going to be joining Chris Gray in the second row?
So this is the guy that I coached with, and I played against once when he was playing for Bath, and I was playing for West Hartlepool. And this is a guy called Martin Haag. And then when I got asked to coach England, I did it part time sevens to combine it with my coaching job at Newbury, and then I went full time. And my first week at Twickenham was to go on tour with the England under 18s to Australia as their backs coach, and forwards coach was Martin. So I just remember really fond memories of, like, that was a pretty cool way to start a new job, fly to Australia with a bunch of young guys that were super keen and really wanted to play. And we had some good players back then, like Courtney Laws and Joe Marler and Carl Ferns and Alex Gray, Jacob Rowan, I think James George was on that tour, Charlie Sharples, Henry Trinder. It was decent. And Martin and me had a similar philosophy how we wanted to play. And I really remember those couple of weeks with fondness. So that's why, as well as being a very good rugby player, Hargy's in the second row.
Yeah, do you know, it's one of those names that I hadn't heard for a little while. And then when you mention it instantly, it takes you back to watching rugby in the 90s. And yeah, kind of a real stalwart for Bath in, you know, when they were a hugely successful side. And like you say, gone on and had a fantastic coaching career as well. Right, Martin Haag, it is in alongside Chris Gray in the second row. Right, very... I keep using the word old school, but it is. It's an uncompromising type five, that. And I like the look of it. Let's see if things change up a little bit when we get into the back row.
Yeah, so I've got at six. He normally played eight, but he couldn't get in front of the guy I picked at eight. But I've done two players that I've coached that I've put in this team. And this is one of them. And this guy was called James Forrester. And he went on and got a handful of caps for England and then had a really serious knee injury playing for Gloucester that unfortunately never recovered from, and he retired from the game really early. And I guess I've got him in because he was one of the most hunted rugby players I've coached. But I had finished playing a game prematurely, got a job supply teaching in comprehensives in London. I was teaching at a school behind IKEA at Wembley and Brent Cross, and then at a school in Southall where I coached football. And then I got a move to a boarding school in Oxford, St Edward's, where they made me kind of their head of rugby, and I was head of PE as well. And Django, James Forrester, was number eight in that team. And he kind of just... Alongside, he had a good guy, Johnny Goodridge, playing at fly half. We also played for Gloucester, and a scrum half that played county cricket called Kenny Bingham. And the three of them were just fantastic. And I guess as a new coach, when you start up, you need a little bit of luck on the beginning of your journey. And I had him in particular that won so many games for that team and had a great start to my coaching career that it helped propel me a little bit more into the spotlight. It gave me, I think, back then it just was... something as simple maybe as the county assistant coach's job or something like that. But it put me a bit more on the map and gave me confidence that what I was doing was right. So it's kind of a thank you for him. And also, you know, I think if he had carried on playing, we would have been talking about him alongside the Delalios and Hills. He was an amazing rugby player.
Yeah, I mean that's really big praise because yeah, like you say, he only had one or two caps for England, but everyone spoke about him as just having such fantastic ability and a real, you know, a great ball playing back row forward and I think anyone connected with Gloucester would say very similar things to what you've just said there, really.
Yeah, no, he was a cracker. So at open side at seven, I've got Richard Hill. Mainly because he's embarrassed me twice. So the first time was when I was playing for Loughborough Freshers. And back then, at the end of the season, you'd have this big jamboree, a final game where you play England Colts at Loughborough. And it was a big game and you designed your own shirt for it and everything else. And so we were playing that year. Richard Hill was there. I was on the left wing. And he just broke off the back of the scrum. I gave him the out, thought I'd give him the outside. As you should really as a winger against a back rower. And he took it and just blazed past me and scored in the corner. And it was in front of all the drunken students and they didn't particularly enjoy that moment for me. And then a few years later, I was playing for West Hartlepool and I'd had a really good game the week before and the week before that. And we were then playing Saracens on the Sunday. And it was at Enfield, I think, where one of the moves they had made, where the football club, and they were, it was a side full of glitter, really. It had Richard Hill at seven. I was playing nine that day opposite Kieran Bracken. Michael Liner was at 10. Seller was in that team. It really was, you name it, that was a great side. But it was in 97, I think, when the Lions were about to get selected on the Sunday or the Monday morning. Kieran Bracken was having ambitions of playing in the British Lions, and I thought they might even name three English scrum halves in that tour. And I was playing well enough to be confident enough to think maybe I'd have an outside crack of the England tour to Argentina that year. And so I started the game with a ton of confidence. After 5 minutes, Richard Hill stamped on my ankle, and that was it, really. Kieran Bracken then took me to the cleaners. I was on one leg playing terribly. Didn't want to go off because I wanted to try to to play the whole game and run it off. And then I remember Mark Ring. I think Mark Ring was more than a little upset. I think he probably had a few quid in us beating Saracens after the week before. And we were in a porter cabin. I got changed. My dad was waiting for me. And I think he said something like, oh, maybe this wouldn't be a bad time to retire. You know, and I was about 23 or 24. I realised I'd had an absolute stinker of a game. And he dropped me off at a pub in Wimbledon where I met a couple of mates to console me. And so that's why Richard Hill's in at seven.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think after those two experiences, it'd be a relief to have him in the same side as you. Keep you out of trouble for a little while there. What about number eight?
Number eight, I'm lucky that I played with some great back rowers. But number eight was a guy that I played with at Cambridge in my first year called Steve Surridge. Steve's gone on to coach and he's an engineer now. But he left Cambridge, played for the Crusaders in New Zealand. They won back-to-back Super Rugby. And then he went on a couple of All Blacks tours and got some caps for the All Blacks at number eight. He was also a black belt judo. I remember going to watch him in the varsity match against Oxford. We drove all the way across to Oxford. And then after 6 seconds, whatever the throw was that you had to do where the bout's all over, he had done it. And then we got back and went back to Cambridge. And he used his judo amazingly well in the way that he would operate in close quarters. He was brilliant off the base. But he was also someone that I always had to room with. They always had eight and nine together rooming. So I'd room with him away games and even big home games. We'd stay the night before in a hotel in Cambridge. And back then, that was when it was amateur still. So I would play with these guys that would then go on and play international rugby, like Steve. Nick Warren was playing in that team that went on to play for Wales and then got that ridiculous ban for not being Welsh, even though he's about the most Welsh person I've ever met. Tom Murphy was playing hooker, went to play for Australia, and Steve Cottrell, who's a New Zealand lawyer now, for the All Blacks was in the centre. But Steve also was the biggest snorer that I've ever met in my life. And I'd go every night that we'd stay in an away game, I'd start in the twin room, hoping that maybe, just maybe, he wouldn't snore this time. He'd snore, so the earplugs would go in, and then the pillows would go round, and it still wouldn't stop. So then I'd end up in the bath. With earplugs and the pillows around me, and that would be the night before any game that we'd play away from home. He was an amazing player, and so for those combination of things, I guess he's in at number eight.
Well, seeing as you're picking this side as well, we'll even let you pick the combination of who rooms with who as well. So if you want to get a good night's kip, you can put Steve in with someone else. Maybe Jeff Probyn. I don't think. I imagine there'll be a lot of snoring going on in that room. Right, well, a pretty formidable pack, but not without a couple of ball players in the back row too. And we look forward to seeing who will be joining them in the backs. And we're going to be doing that after this very, very short break. Right, time now, Ben, for you to let us know who is in your back division. Of course, first we'll be starting with the scrum half. Are you tempted to slot yourself in here?
No, I can just about bend down these days. I've had some good battles against different scrum halves, and I can think about playing against Dowie Morris or Kieran Bracken, amongst others, I guess, Matt Dawson when he was at Saints. Two guys really that got in. One was Brian Redpath, because he played against me in Melrose Sevens. Both got to the final. Obviously, he was playing for the home club, and they hadn't won their own tournament for a long, long time. And I think out of their seven, six of them were current Scottish internationals, and they played well. But he absolutely took me to the cleaners. It was a perfect show from how to play Niners in Sevens. And I was going to put him in, but then I've actually slipped in Peter Richards, who played against when he was at Irish, when I was at Hartlepool. And I remember playing against Irish, I got a bang in the head. And back then, I used to get these weird concussions that were, they make you fail. So you'd get a bang on the head, you'd be looking down at what was going on in the field, and you could you could say, well, I know that that guy's going to pass the ball to him. He's going to chip it and then he's going to get tackled. And that's what happened. And you thought you had some sort of weird ability to have a sixth sense, but it was just your brain had seen all of this, but somehow hadn't processed it. And then I had one of those moments against Llanarish. And then I went to put the ball in at a scrum for Hartlepool. And I went round the wrong side of the scrum. And Pete Richards just said, that's the wrong side. He said, I don't normally swear, but he said, that's the wrong side, you fucking mong. And I didn't really have any comeback to him other than, yeah, that's not the best thing to do as a scrum half, to try to put the ball in on the wrong side. So I went round the other side, and then I think he nicked the ball off me at the scrum. And it was another one of those moments where I had an awful game. But he was coming up the ranks of a very talented scrum half that that probably could have done more of his career. But I've got him in at 9.
Well, yeah, and ended up playing in a World Cup final, of course. And again, memory serves me correctly, he was in some weird, you know, did he end up in the centre or on the flank in that World Cup final?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But I remember he lost. He forgot to take his boots to one Test match. Maybe that was in the tour of hell. What coming point that was, yeah.
Like 798 or something, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, Peter Richards is in at 9. Gonna have a look at fly half now. What kind of fly half did you like to play alongside? Was there a particular, you know, did you like to have a strong kicking option outside of you, or did you prefer to have someone who could kind of run it from all over?
I just loved a 10 that wouldn't stop talking, that would always be kind of navigating me and telling me whether to play the ball into the forwards a little bit, or let him have it, or when to do things. I liked that direction. And actually at Cambridge, I had a good young fly half that had just come out of England schools called Rob Ashforth, and he ended up playing for various Northern clubs, and he was at Llanarish for a while. But he doesn't make my 10 slot. And I was lucky, I played against some good Paul Turner when I was at Bedford. You know, he demanded that ball had to be delivered exactly where he wanted it, or he'd just throw it back at you at training. But he just could kick the ball off either foot and was amazing. And Mark Ring, even though he was coaching at Hartlepool, when you know, you're warming up, he'd talk you through how to kick the ball on the outside of your foot, spinning the wrong way or whatever it was to do something, and he'd have some pretty cool back row moves as well that involved you. But the guy that I put at 10, I put him really because I thought it was just quite a momentous moment. It was a game playing for Cambridge, and it was against Cardiff, and it was on a Friday night. Saturday Wales were playing Fiji, and Jonathan Davis was making his return back to rugby union from rugby league. So it was a full house at the Arms Park, and which was just called full stop, really. And Jonathan was playing at 10 that day. And so just the fact that I'd watched him playing league, I'd watched him playing union, I just thought he was such a good footballer, so quick, that it was just a pleasure really just to be on the same field as him. So he's my number 10.
I think we've done about 12 or 14 of these Dream 15 episodes now, and he has been the one who's been picked the most consistently. I think people just, you know, we've had a lot of people who've played with him, you know, Phil Davis and kind of Rupert Moon talking about him as well. But he is just one of those players who, you know, whether you've played with him or you've watched him as a fan, he just delights players in the, sorry, he just delights he's just a delight to watch, you know, and particularly when he's at his absolute best, just, you know, unplayable, really.
Yeah, no, he's terrific, and I'm lucky enough that I've worked with him a bit in media stuff and various other things around the world since, and he's just a lovely guy, so and very funny, so. He'd be great off-field banter as well, just because Steve Sturridge at number 8 didn't really smile, so we would need some fun in there. Looking at that pack, there's not a lot going on really. So him and Trevor Leota probably at the moment would have to be doing their bit,
keeping morale up. Right, let's see if that improves as we start to have a look at the wingers. Let's start with the 11 jersey.
Yeah, I think he probably played 14 more, but. I'll swap it around a bit. Yeah, 11, I've got another rugby league player that I played along. Well, I trained alongside, and then we were in the same team, but he got picked ahead of me when I wasn't playing 9, and that's Martin Afire. Mm.
So this is in Bedford, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's Bedford when he came back. He came to Bedford, and again, that was when they had a lot of money and got promoted that year. But I remember it really because, again, a bit like Jonathan, it was Martin's first game back into Union, and so all the cameras were at Goldenton Road to watch him make his debut. And in the warm up, he bashed his toe doing something that ruled him out of the game. So I went from being on the bench to going on to the left wing, and all the cameras were there, light bulbs flashing, ready to watch Martin do his thing in the first game. And out came this little ginger bloke wearing his shirt, and they just had all these collective sighs when they saw me running on the field, and half the ground disappeared in the first 10 minutes. But for that reason, really, I've got Martin in there at 11, because it was a memory that I've still not managed to shake off.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, because I remember Martin Afire playing league, you know, and watching him. Some of that, you know, one of the try he scored against Leeds in the Challenge Cup final, whenever that was, you know, it's one of the greatest feats of athletic ability you'll ever see in any sport. It just, you know, and it just looks incredible. And I always just, you know, I think he's one of those players that, if he was, you know, if he was in his 20s now, he would fit into the modern game just because of the way he approached it, whether it was league or union.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and like with my sevens hat on, can you imagine what he would have done? I mean, he did some amazing things for that Wigan team at Middlesex Sevens, when the one that Sean Edwards was in as well. But he would have been unbelievable on the seven circuit as well. So yeah, a real talent.
It's been doing the rounds, the video of that of the one with Wigan in it, and I watched the entire. It was Wasps or Harlequins they played in the final. I watched the entire video of it the other day, and it's just amazing because you've got guys who've been professional their entire careers, just applying that to a completely different form of the game and making it look so easy. You know, players, and that was a mixture of players. You know, obviously Martin Afire had played Union. I think perhaps at that stage Jason Robinson might have done a little bit. I think he played briefly for Bath, but then you had other players like Farrell and Radlinski in there who'd never played any form of Union and made it look so easy. It was just it's an astonishing thing to watch, actually, looking back at it.
Well, yeah, and I guess it showed you that when you're a professional athlete, you know, what gains you can make from a physical side, and that, and you know, when we were still amateur in the Union game and they were professional, not only did they have better skill set, they're just on a different planet as far as athletic ability. And obviously that's changed now, and Union players certainly can go toe-to-toe, and the rugby league players like the Jared Haynes's of this world that I've coached alongside some of the Union, certainly, I think Union players are as athletic as their league counterparts, if not probably more at the moment these days.
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right. But yeah, Martin Afire, that's it's starting to look like a very exciting back division. Let's go over to the other wing then.
Yeah, on the other wing is, I thought I'd have a bit of some more Welshmen in there, and this was a guy that I played against. He played for Llanelli and was captain. Jan Evans. So, and it was, I remember going to Stradley Park, and again, it was quite a difficult environment as not just a ginger, short-sighted, left-handed Englishman, but also playing for Cambridge University, you know, as a bunch of students. And back then it was, you know, these friendlies were full bore. So Scarlets had their full side out. I was getting abused by, I think there was a Welsh priest that would run up and down the touchline shouting abuse, and I got most of that all day. I then got punched by Yian, I think, as I tackled him in the grandstand, and then the referee, we were winning the game, the last kick of the game, he decided to give a random penalty to Scarlets that they had in front of the post. I think the referee just wanted to get invited back to referee again, and so Scarlets won the game that day. But I remember, again, it was another one where this was a guy that I'd watched playing for Wales on telly, and it was a real honour to be sharing the pitch with him.
Yeah, again, it'll come as no surprise that he's another one who's been consistently selected throughout this, and was an absolute joy to watch at his best, which was pretty much his entire career. You know, consistently brilliant
scored incredible number of tries, particularly for that period of time, and playing in some, you know, in some Wales sides that were really, you know, that were really struggling, you know, the kind of the mid to late 90s, you know, there wasn't a lot of joy and a lot of wins for Wales. So one of those players who just always did it. Interesting there, you kind of touching on Stradley Park, you know, the, obviously this pod has taken a bit of a theme of looking back at some of the amateur, the aspects of the amateur game. I suppose with that comes those stadiums that are very, very hard to play in. You know, those grounds, I suppose grounds is a better word for it, because you've got the players right on top of you. Whereas I think, you know, sometimes, you know, with no disrespect to the Ospreys, you know, if you're playing in front of 4,500 rattling around the Liberty, it's not the same as if you're playing in a tough environment like the Knoll or like Stradley Park or like Rodney Parade, where you've got people breathing down your neck.
Yeah, no, and I was lucky that I got to play in a lot of the Welsh grounds, because when I was younger, my mum's Welsh background, grandparents, my granddad played cricket for Glamorgan and was also a minor, and so I kind of, just to appease her a little bit, I played a bit for Welsh Exiles, but quickly realised, like in the changing rooms of Aldham when they were singing the Welsh anthem, that just couldn't. It wasn't really me, but we got to, as Welsh Exiles, we'd play these often, like midweek night games at places like Newport or Cross Keys or Glamorgan Wanderers or Swansea, against the regions or the districts or however they were made up back then, and they were brilliant. I just loved it, you know, just proper rugby grounds that had a real atmosphere to them.
Yeah, no, I think that's it is definitely one of the things that. That I kind of much prefer to go and watch rugby in an old fashioned ground and be right on top, rather than, you know, kind of a bit of a Lego stadium. Let's have a look at the centres now, Ben. What are you opting for here?
I've played against a ton of great ones, but I've gone for someone that I've played with, who's now the team manager at Montpellier, in the top 14 in France, and before that was the team manager for Toulon for a long time. Tom Whitford, or Twitford, as most of us called him, and he was this archetypal, quite bumbling, posh Englishman that played for Cambridge. He then went on to play for Richmond and then captained Toulon and got them promoted, and at the same moment suffered a bad knee injury, and the owner at the time promised Tom a job for life. And that's pretty much what happened until he left for Montpellier. And he was just like another one, great value off the field. He was 100%er. He would take the ball on. I remember him going on an Easter tour once where he was also a fellow redhead, and he wore a wig for the entire Easter tour. And it was only whilst he was playing in one of the games that he took a crash ball and his wig flew off, and the opposition genuinely felt his head had gone, that they realised that it was a wig. And he would just randomly, if you needed brightening up, he'd tell you a random story. I remember he once was looking after his girlfriend's dog, and the dog drowned in the swimming pool, and he knew the dog was dead, but the girlfriend was very upset, and so Tom had to try to resuscitate poor Horace for minutes as the blood and the everything else was going into Tom's mouth, and he would just have just one story after another around that. So he would, with Jonathan Davis, I think they would actually make a good partnership off the field more perhaps than on the field.
That is absolutely brilliant. When you said it, I you know, I'm a bit of a rugby nerd, and I mean, you said it, I thought, God, I'm not going to be able to add much to this. But when you've got stories like playing an entire Easter tour in a wig and trying to resuscitate a dog that you accidentally drowned, there's nothing more I need to add. So Tom Whitford is welcome to that number 12 shirt.
Yeah, brilliant.
All right, outside centre.
Yeah, so he's the only other player that I've got in here, because I probably owe him the most in my career than any other player, and that's my Fijian Sevens captain, Osea Kolinsau. So he plays now in the MLR. He's in Houston, or they're just about to draft somewhere else, I think. And he's just one of those players that was just a huge leader, a real cultural architect. I wouldn't have survived my time in Fiji without him. And in my first week I was there, I inherited a team that 8 selectors had picked. I didn't know any of them. And one of them broke their leg in one of the tournaments before we went to my first World Series event. And so I could select Oscar. And the Fijian Rugby Union told me he was bad news. He was a troublemaker. And I thought, well, that's the sort of bloke that I want in my team. And he was none of those things other than an amazing leader. And when we talk about Fijian sevens, it's normally Waisali Serevi and occasionally William Ryder. But Osea's, you know, one more things than probably any of those guys. One more Hong Kong's, one more world titles, Olympic gold medal winning captain. And certainly a future Fijian sevens head coach and a coach at any other level of the game. He's a bright, engaging guy. So I had to put him in somewhere. And 13 in his pomp, I think he would have done a good job.
Oh, it's a great pick. And it's really interesting there you say that, you know, that things could have been slightly differently, particularly if the selectors had their way. How convinced were you that he was the right choice from the outset?
Yeah, I mean, not that I want to plug my book, but I did talk about him quite a lot in Sevens Heaven on that, those meetings where I kind of met him and his dad. His dad's an amazing man as well. And like, basically, you know, we both needed each other at that time in our career. I was disillusioned with the game and I hoped Fiji was going to give me a reset button. Osea had been dropped for standing up for the rights of the players and coaches had just ignored him. And he was ready just to kick it all to touch. And then I came along and put him in the team and made him captain. And you know, and the two of us were tight for those 3 years. And, you know, he was one of those captains that leads by example. So after a couple of games, he's passed out on my shoulder with the amount of effort that he's put in. And nobody could ever doubt that. So he'd also be captain of this team as well. But I absolutely, he was integral to everything that we did in Fiji.
Right, the captain's armband and the number 13 shirt to Osea Kolinosau. Right, only one position left, and that is fullback.
Yeah, and this is a toss-up between two Englishmen, really. One was Josh Lucy, and Josh is in the team because I remember playing with him for the Penguins in the Kuala Lumpur 10s, and he was only 18, and he'd just come off either stop. Finished playing for England schools or Colts or somebody, and he had this amazing confidence I'd never had seen in any young player. And we lost to the New Zealand Maoris in the semi-final, but the night before, myself and one of the other players had gone to get a McDonald's had this terrible food poisoning. So I was in the toilet before the game at halftime and after the game, and at one point in the semi-final, when I got tackled by my opposite number, I was also, unfortunately, did a number two on the field. And that was very embarrassing. I can only really apologise to him for that. But Josh was in that team. But he didn't make it. And the guy that made it is one that I was at Loughborough with and then played with a little bit, but I used to play a bit at fullback as well, and he played, got some caps for England on that Argentina tour in 97. That's Mark Mapletoft. Mm. And Mark's in for a number of reasons. Firstly, a lot of rugby players will often say, oh, do you know what, if I'd chosen football, I could have been a professional footballer. And then you just have a kick around with them and realise they're rubbish. Mark is genuinely was an amazing footballer, and he was on the books at Coventry, but he could undoubtedly have played professional football at a very high level. I'm very talented in that respect. I remember playing for Midlands under 21s with him against Midlands A at Northampton. He scored 21 points on his 21st birthday, which I thought was kind of cool. But also he's kind of like it's a bit of a thank you, I suppose. When I got asked by England to apply for various roles when I was at Newbury, it was England under 20s that they asked me to apply for. And Mark also went for that job. And the sevens job then became available at the same time. So they said to us, you know a bit more about sevens than Mark does, so why don't you do the sevens team? Mark does the 20s, and after a year, we can have a look at it and maybe swap it around. And we said, yeah, no problem. And then the rest really happened. I stuck to sevens and had the next 15 years and set various sevens teams, and Mark had a really and is having a really good career as a 15s coach. So I guess if that decision hadn't been made, I probably wouldn't be on this podcast talking to you.
There we go. And that's actually been a bit of a theme running through, hasn't it? You've been sure to thank some of those players who've had a key role in your career. And Mark Mapletoft gets the 15 shirt. Right, there are a couple more remaining questions, Ben. I can't even remember if I warned you about these. So you might
You
might have to think on your feet. So you've already named the captain, which is great. And that sounded like a very easy pick. You also get to choose the opposition. So if you could have this side take on any side from history, who would you like to see them take on?
Oh, gosh, any side from history. I would take the Fijian team that beat Wales in the World Cup in France and then should have beat South Africa to get to those semi-finals. But that team with Raoul Looney and Seremaia Bai and so many amazing Fijian players, and they were on fire in that tournament. So it would make for a very fun game.
It would, and I'm still having nightmares about that team, so that's a wise choice. And you also get to choose the grounds where this would take place. Obviously, we've spoken about some of those great old grounds already on this podcast, but you would also get to choose the location of where you'd like to see this take place. It could be any grounds, either existing or older.
Crikey, I wouldn't go for a big flash ground, I don't think. I don't think that's quite in line with the team that I picked. So it would either be going to get back to Grange Road and playing there at Cambridge Play, or it would have to be I'd take it to the Yasawa Islands in Fiji and go to Yasawa Village where they have a sevens tournament every year. The pitch is in the middle of the village. I remember going to watch a tournament there, and when I got there, they had put a couch on the halfway line for me. The women had prepared me a big urn of sugary tea and a load of fluorescent cakes for me and a parasol. And I sat and watched village rugby, sevens rugby for the first time. And then we all got on little boats to go back to various places where we were going to stay that evening in the Yasawas. So I think that would have to take it. And all the players would certainly enjoy going there and then having a lovo, like a barbecue afterwards, where it's like a hangi, where it's cooked under the ground. I think that would be a lot of fun.
Sounds amazing. I'll tell you what, you can even make it a two test series if you like. So you can have the first one at Grange Road, and then you can go on and enjoy yourself out in the Yasawa Islands. So I'll give you a pass on that. And then the final question is, you also get to choose the jersey that the team would pull on. Is there a particular colour or a particular jersey that you'd like to see this team take the field in?
Well, I think I'm going to, this is just, I think I'm, these days, like, I love watching my rugby, but I'm also a pretty passionate Brentford football supporter, and we are going through halcyon days at the moment, third in the championship, and actually with a realistic chance that the promised land might actually happen. And the old school red and white striped vertical shirt with the old KLM sponsors that they used to have over the top of the stadium at Griffin Park, and those old school shirts. I think I'd make the team play in those.
Fantastic. I love that. And again, it ties it all nice together, because talking about great grounds to watch sport, Griffin Park is undoubtedly one of those one of those fantastic old places. Ben, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for joining us. Really enjoyed a look at that team. Some familiar names in there, and some not so familiar, but a story for each of them. So thank you very much for joining us.
No problem, Jed. Really, really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Sports Social Podcast Network.